It's Wednesday, the 22nd of January, 2025, and you're listening to Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. It's tempting, Phil, I'm sure you're tempted as well, to simply talk about what's going on the other side of the Atlantic.
Oh, God, no.
It's quite an exciting, it's rather like watching Netflix, but I'm sure that we will notice a few ripples coming across this side of the pond, but maybe we'll save that discussion for another time. There's plenty going on over here at the moment for us to talk about, so what should we talk about first? We've got several interesting topics.
Well, we have got a bit of a programme of things to talk about. I'd like to do a quick mention to a couple of stories that we've run the past couple of days on the Construction Index, but I think we'll come back and talk about these at greater length another time, perhaps.
Yeah, okay.
First one, front page of the Times this morning, Labour curbs environmental quangos to get Britain building.
Wow.
And they're saying that, and they've quoted, I think they quoted both Angela Rayner, the Environment Secretary, and the DEFRA Secretary, Steve Reid, the Environment Secretary. Sorry, the Local Government Secretary, Angela Rayner, and the DEFRA one, Steve Reid.
Yeah.
Basically saying that they're going to clip the wings of the environmental quangos, Nature England in particular. And instead of them, Nature England being able to say, you can't do that because of newts and bats, they're going to say you can offset it. So if you want to build a housing estate and there are newts there, they'll say, okay, murder the
kill
newts.
Kill the newts.
kill the newts, but give us some money and we'll go plant some newts somewhere else.
We know that that works, don't we?
That'll be okay. So that's what they're saying. What the Times, I mean, they quoted the HS2 bat tunnel story, which keeps coming up. What they missed was that the same time that they were writing this story, Norfolk County Council was announcing that they'd withdrawn their planning application for, well, not the planning application, but their bid for final sign-off, essentially the planning process, for the Norwich Western Link Road, which is a £274 million project that Ferrovial, the Spanish contractor, has been waiting to get started on for several years now. And this is because Natural England said, oh, you can't do that. There's lots of bats. What sort of bats are they?
Bats. Bats are bats.
Anyway, some sort of bat. And the council did all sorts of, you know, trying to figure their way around it. Here we go. Barbersdale bats. I don't know what Barbersdale bats
is. Never heard of those. Never heard of them.
The only bats I know are table tennis bats and cricket bats, to be honest. But anyway, for whatever reason, they could find no way around it and said, well, you know, we still want to build this road, but we're going to have to, you know, go back to the drawing board and see where we go from here. So it scuppered that. So anyway, apparently this new clipping the wings of Nature England will come into, or Natural England, I should say, will come into force with the infrastructure and planning bill that we're being promised for later in the year. So that was worth a quick mention.
Okay.
The other thing that's worth a quick mention, which, I mean, it's absolutely no surprise at all, is that these 40 hospitals that Boris Johnson promised in 2020 that he was going to get built in the next 10 years, which were never actually new hospitals. A lot of them were, you know, new wings, extensions,
yes,
whatever,
exactly.
New departments. But billions of pounds worth of projects. You know, it's always pie-in-the-sky stuff, but this was even before other things intervened. So what's now happened is that the new government, Wes Streeting, the new health secretary, has come up with a new timetable. So instead of them all being built by 2030, they're going to be all built by the mid-2040s. Basically, they're phases. Some will start in the back end of this decade. Some will start at the beginning of the next decade. And others will start at the back end of the next decade. So, you know, some of them aren't even going to start till 2038, 2039.
Yeah.
So this is no surprise. Although it makes me think, they're saying this is a new program, a new plan. If you're planning to start something in 15 years' time, is that really planning?
It's not really a plan, is it? No, it's not. It's just saying, not my problem, Governor.
Anyway, let's not dwell on those.
Okay.
We may well come back to them. I think the first topic we should talk about, David, is solar panels.
Yes.
Why don't all new houses have solar panels on them? It seems to be an absolute no-brainer. If you're building a house, put a solar panel on it. And why not? It stands to reason.
Well, that was the thinking behind a bill which had its Did it have its first reading last week?
Second reading.
Yeah, it was the, I can't remember the name of the MP. He's the MP for Cheltenham.
Max Wilkinson,
Liberal,
his name.
Liberal Democrat MP, yeah.
That's a good Liberal Democrat policy, isn't it?
Well, yeah, you'd think so. I mean,
compulsory greenness.
Yes. I mean, I've we've talked about solar panels and where they should go in the past. You know, we don't like them being all over our green and pleasant land and, you know, taking up valuable agricultural land and all the rest of it. And that, in fact, that was a major argument in the discussion. We've said in the past that, for example, public buildings like hospitals and schools and then private, you know, commercial buildings like factories and offices and stuff like that should really have solar panels on if we're serious about renewable energy, rather than spreading all these panels over fields which could be growing food. We should put them on buildings which have nice big roofs, you know, to accommodate them. Well, this chap, whose name I've forgotten again already, suggested that, yeah, when you're building a new house, it should come with roof-mounted solar panels. And on the face of it, sounds like a win-win.
Argue.
It's a great idea. Somebody pointed out that it wasn't actually him. It was one of his Liberal Democrat colleagues pointed out that the extra cost as a proportion of the total amount is minuscule, because I think it's about £5,500 it would cost you to factor in the solar panels on a new house, and the average price of a new house now is about £400,000. So it's tiny. It's really tiny. But, you know, so you'd think, well, yeah, it's a no-brainer. Go for it. But unfortunately, Mr. Pennycook is Pennycook, isn't it?
The planning minister.
Planning minister. I can't remember his first name. I should have made a note of these names, because I'm terrible with names. I knew I'd forget them. But anyway, right at the end of the discussion, which was very entertaining and raised some very interesting points, he poured cold water on the whole thing and said, "No, well, we're not going to support the bill." And the reason became quite clear, and in fact made perfect sense. And all of a sudden, the bill didn't seem to be a no-brainer at all, because of course we've got the Future Home Standard coming in this year, haven't we? And that's all about making new homes climate friendly and zero carbon and all the rest of it. And indeed, roof-mounted solar panels are part of that mix. But the point being made by the government is that if we introduce primary legislation just about the solar panels, it's going to throw a huge spanner in the works, and it's going to simply delay things. And there are other very logistical objections to it. For example, you've got to get all these roof-mounted solar panels to feed into the grid, because of course they're not simply going to power your fridge and your washing machine. They're going to contribute to the electricity mix for the national grid. And that is difficult and that is slow. And so it could slow down the provision of new homes.
That's already a big pinch point, isn't it? Getting the plugged into the grid, new homes anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And there are other things. For example, I know that modern new build houses all look the same to some people, but they're not all the same. You know, there are different designs. And if you're going to legislate for putting solar panels on roofs, that's going to put a huge burden on local planning authorities to make sure that, well, they've got to administer it. They've got to make sure that it's enforced. And also house builders have to modify their designs in order to provide the amount of solar panel that the bill suggests. I think they said 40% of the floor space of a house should, you know, or the equivalent of 40% of the house's floor space should be mounted as solar panels on the roof. And that doesn't work for every roof design. For example, if you've got dormers on a roof, then that will rob some of the space available. So you can't do it. So in the end, I think everybody went away sort of not entirely satisfied, but satisfied that a consensus had been reached, which was that solar panels are a good idea. We do want to encourage their use and their application on new homes, but we're not going to legislate for it.
But what I found quite interesting is that the the Liberal Democrat MP for Cheltenham who put it forward, and his name's Max Wilkinson, Dave.
Yes, okay, thanks. All
he,
right.
he, you know, beforehand was going, I've got this bill, and various green organisations saying, yes, let's get behind this bill. It makes sense. It's a great idea, great idea. And afterwards, he put out a message on whatever people put out messages on these days, saying, it's great that the government are listening to me, and they're going to bring in solar panel requirements in the future standards. You know, this is coming. We've won, folks. So, not exactly. No,
it was already happening. It was already happening. Well, I thought one of the most entertaining interjections was by a Conservative MP.
Let me guess, you're going to come up with Chris Chope, are you?
Chris Chope, he was Chris Chope, yeah. Who said, what about thatched roofs? I thought that is so Home Counties Tory, you know.
Well, more than that, he rivals Jacob Rees-Mogg for being the honourable member for the 18th century.
Yes, yes, exactly. So that was quite a good one. But so it was an interesting. I did actually read nearly all of the debate. Skimmed over some bits. There's quite a lot of repetition. But the honourable members had great fun with their puns. I can't remember some of them, but they were mostly very painful puns. So it was a lively discussion and enjoyed by one and all. And I think probably ended on a fairly positive note. But underlying the whole thing, of course, was a serious point about meeting our zero carbon commitments and reducing carbon emissions. I think everybody seemed to accept that was entirely right. Nobody said, forget about the carbon reduction targets. They're not going to happen anyway. Let's just build houses without solar panels and don't worry about it. Nobody actually said that, not even Christopher Chope. So in a way, it did sort of, I thought it sort of illustrated the unity of purpose within the House of Commons. And we are going to get solar panels, but it'll be up to the house, the homeowner, to decide that they want the panels, and they can have them fitted themselves. After all, it's only £5,500, and most people who spent £400,000 on a new home would be able to stretch a little bit further and do that themselves.
I'm intrinsically in favour of letting the market decide these things rather than legislating. I mean, so many examples. We'll come on to one in a little bit. Later in this conversation today, David, about the idea of everyone thinks it's, government must do something. They must legislate and legislate now and think later.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, as the National Federation of Builders made the point, that there are numerous examples of legislation which seems like common sense and everyone's crying out for, but actually, when you look at the detail and see the execution of it, the unintended consequences can be quite destructive and damaging.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So like a lot of good ideas on the on the surface, you dig a little deeper and all sorts of objections seem to surface. But
that doesn't answer the question, why aren't the big house builders just routinely putting on solar panels anyway? I mean, I know it can make some houses, a lot of houses are being retrofitted with solar panels. It can really look quite disfiguring and ruin the look of an otherwise attractive building. But there are products on the market now where the solar panel doesn't look like a solar panel. It just looks like the roof tiles. It's sort of tiled in.
Exactly. I'm not sure you could get a very big array simply made out of roof tiles. I don't know. I know that I think people like Redland and Russell's roof tiles probably offer these things. I don't know whether or not you can simply use tiles rather than panels to provide sufficient amount of photovoltaic.
But they're bedded in now, but they're bedded in, sort of sticking out and looking ugly.
But I also think that, if we're talking about new homes, modern houses, I mean, my objection to retrofitting solar panels to houses is that, as you just said, some old houses which look really nice and have good proportions and pleasant, sort of mellow slate roofs and stuff like that, look dreadful with these gleaming panels on the roof. I don't think it enhances their appearance at all. But with a new house, it can be part of the design. You're building a house out of new materials anyway. There's an awful lot of PVCU there. There's an awful lot of cement and aluminium and goodness knows what else. Some sort of shiny glass panels on the roof could be actually made into a feature. You could redesign the roof. I mean, if you look at the way that house builders build these days and the designs that they offer, they're very, very conservative in a sort of a pastiche way. So you have, roofs made with concrete tiles, which are a token gesture towards looking like conventional clay tiles. Well, most of them don't. You can spot a concrete tile a mile away. And it's the same with artificial slates. People want, for some reason, the house building industry assumes, and probably quite rightly, that the average house buyer in the UK wants, the typical sort of doll's house appearance: a front door in the middle, four windows, a roof, and possibly even a GRP chimney on the top, a fake chimney, just to make it look like a real house. Well, maybe people should sort of experiment with slightly more outre designs, more modern designs, and say, actually, solar panels on the roof, they are actually part of a roof now. That's what roofs look like, and start building accordingly. And I don't see why people would object to that.
You've been watching that Kevin MacLeod again, haven't you?
I haven't. No, is he still around?
I have no idea.
Well, anyway, no, I think that solar panels on roofs, if you believe that solar photovoltaic panels are a solution or part of the solution to the carbon debate, then go for it and stick them on the roofs of new houses. Build houses with them as part of the structure, and I think that's perfectly fine. Just do it.
I agree.
So what's next?
Well, I hinted that we were going to come onto a topic of legislating for something that seems like a good idea.
Yeah. Oh, this is one of your favourite hobby horses. I know what you're going to talk about.
Yeah, it is a bit. This is the whole question of whether construction contractors should be required to have a licence to say that they are competent and qualified to carry out building works. We've talked in the past about how the Federation of Master Builders thinks that no one should be allowed to do any patio works or extensions kitchen extensions or whatever, unless they've got a license to do so. That there should be a barriers to entry to the building trade.
Yeah,
and their focus is very much on the B2C, the business to consumer market rather than B2B. Domestic repair and maintenance type stuff, refurb stuff, and their ostensible argument is that it will drive out the cowboys, raise standards, and will stop, rogue traders and bad actors. Well, it won't, because we have to have a driving license, and there's still plenty of people who are bad drivers, who drive too fast and cause crashes and so on and so forth. Even though the Federation of Master Builders says that 90% of their members support this idea, I think 90% of their members are wrong and have been misguided. They need to think it through a bit more. This is sort of legislation that just ends in trouble. Different aspect of the licensing contractors argument came up in the Grenfell Tower Inquiry final report, which was published last September. And we talked about it at length at the time about other aspects. I mean, there was masses in that report, a lot of it good stuff. Some of it has just been, frankly, people have sort of, they didn't really say that, did they? Like nationalizing the whole product testing universe, putting all of that in the state section, getting state controlled. I mean, why? I mean, wow. But one of the recommendations was that contractors working on higher risk buildings, which at the time I think was defined as multi-occupancy residential buildings of at least 7 stories or 18 meters in height, that contractors working on those buildings should have to have a license. So if all these people get their way, you've got to have a license to go work in number 27 Acacia Avenue's conservatory extension or whatever, and you've got to have a license to work on a 7-story building. But anything in between, you're fine. which seems bizarre. Anyway, the reason why I'm talking about it now, the reason why I'm talking about it, the newspaper for this, the Royal Institute of British Architects, REBA, they just last week published their immediately after the inquiry report, they came out, as did everyone, and said, yep, we agree. This is great. This is great. We agree. You know, rah, rah, the report. And now they've had a few months to think about it, and they've had meetings and seminars and talking about it, and they've produced a much lengthier, more sort of considered report, talking in detail about all sorts of things in it. And again, they're basically supporting it. But the one thing which I thought was particularly interesting, what they're saying on the subject of a licensing regime for tier one building contractors, they said, yeah, we agree with it for multi-occupancy residential buildings of you know, these high-risk buildings, but the definition of what they should work on should be widened, include any assembly buildings, temporary leisure establishments. I can only think that means fairgrounds and circuses.
I was going to say bouncy castles, yeah.
Yeah, probably that too. So you'd have a license to blow up a bouncy castle.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, if putting up circuses and fairgrounds, I'm all for regulating that, but I'm sure that already is. I mean, it's got local authority regulations, yeah. I think.
Always looks terribly dangerous to me anyway.
Yeah. But there's also some suggestion that, you know, less high buildings would come into the remit, I think.
Yeah.
So we agree with the recommendation that a license, this is a quote from Bieber, we agree with the recommendation that a licensing scheme operated by the construction regulator be introduced for principal contractors. However, we believe this should be wider than for higher risk buildings. There is concern about competence across many building types.
Mm.
So, okay, they're going to widen it out. So how far are they going to widen it? And then it's going to be for buildings, and then for you know, extensions and conservatories. Mm. But then not for bridges? Anyone can put up a bridge? Is that going to
be
the
exactly, case? Yes. Or tunnels. Or, yeah.
And you just think, okay, so anyway, ultimately you follow it through, and if everyone gets their way on this thing, I'm not going to be allowed to play with a bucket and spade on the beach.
Well, you know, I thought that there was a sort of, didn't they call it the Building Licensing Task Force or something, which was set up? This was about 5 years ago, wasn't it, when Federation of
the
Master FMB, Builders.
Is this the Master Builders you're talking about?
Yeah. But that, I thought that died a death. Are you saying that it's still there?
Yeah. They're still pushing it, and they still, you know, come out with it every so often, and still part of their lobbying. And I've said before, what they really need to be lobbying for is to make domestic repair and maintenance work not vattable. That's the problem.
Yes.
That's why I don't go to a competent builder when I've got a small building job doing in my house. I'll go to a competent builder, I hope.
Why pay 20% more?
Exactly. And this is what really is damaging, or a thorn in the side of your sort of SME builders who are members of the FMB, is that they're automatically 20% more expensive because they're not, you know, tiny one-man band, or one-man person outfits. And they do go on about that, but they think that's a losing battle, where somehow they think that, oh, if we, you know, building licensing scheme, everyone will get on board with that. That's more politically acceptable.
Mm.
Well, I think there comes a time you have to say, let's not play political games with this. Let's just keep the moral high ground. That is the issue.
Yeah.
You know, to be or not to be, that is the question. Not licensing and state regulation and state control and you said it's a hobby horse of mine. It just goes against, no, I mean, it does seem common sense you have to have a license, but why? I mean, license for everything.
It's another one of these.
Stop.
It's becoming a theme, Phil. It's one of those good ideas on the surface,
yeah,
which when you scratch the surface, doesn't look quite so good after all. I mean, there are all sorts of problems, as you say, and it doesn't make sense. Certainly not in a domestic arena. And I think, I mean, licensing tier one contractors, I mean, at what point, I don't know.
But it's a local authority thing. If you don't, maybe you should say that if you need to get planning permission, you've got to say who's going to do the work as part of your condition of planning. Mm. And the local authority or the local planning authority can say, well, we like this idea, but we don't think that company has quite got the credentials to build that bridge or that skyscraper. Mm. You haven't, the engineer is not actually a qualified, you know, a member of the, you know, Institute of Structural or Civil Engineers or whatever.
Mm.
I mean, in the old days, it used to be that you had the professional bodies, you know, a resident engineer who was professionally qualified, recognised person with, you recognise those qualifications, say, if they sign it off, they're responsible.
Yes.
And if it falls down, it's their fault.
That's right. It was self-regulating, really.
Yeah. which goes back another hobby horse of mine. The reason why Grenfell happened in large part is because we don't have that, and it's design and build. And therefore, yeah, it suddenly becomes blurred, you know, liabilities and everyone and no one suddenly responsible.
Well, there you are. There's another great, can of worms. Anyway.
So Reber, you're wrong, which is ironic because Reber previously has argued for the role of the architect to be given more status, like the resident engineer in infrastructure project, the architect in the building project. There should be the project architect who is
That's the way it was, wasn't it?
That can be done, that can't be done. This is what's safe and this is what not safe, and they carry the can. And for Reber to say you should have licensing contractors, they're basically saying we abrogate our responsibility of being in charge. Let the state take charge of what's suitable and what's not suitable. Mm. And I'd rather the professions did that themselves.
Yeah, they'd probably argue that that's not at all what they're saying, but because it makes it sound as if we're not as important as we thought we were. But I agree with you. There was a system in place which worked, or supposedly worked.
Grenfell Tower suggested it didn't, but I'm saying that Grenfell Tower was not because of lack of licensing scheme. It was, if anything, it was more to do with the whole design and build world that we've been enmeshed in.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, I'm sure I'll come back to that one again. And sorry if you're bored of hearing me talk about that, folks, but I still think it needs saying ever so often. What do you want to talk about next? What's coming up next, David?
Well, there's there've been a few sort of readjustments in the plant hire sector, which we've discussed a couple of them recently. Just plant hire companies basically repositioning themselves, changing direction slightly. We talked about Ardent. Do you remember? I think this was only just before Christmas. Ardent, which of course was set up by the merger of Fork Rent and
One Call Hire, was it?
Yeah, One Call Hire, that's right, yes.
And One Call Hire was essentially, you know, diggers and
small
dumpers
and
whatever. Yeah. Earth-moving stuff.
Yeah.
And Fork Hire's name is just telehandlers.
Telehandlers. And then Ardent sort of combined the two, but now they've sort of retrenched again and they've said, right, we're just going to do telehandlers. We're getting rid of the small plant, which is quite interesting, going back to their core, well, the core expertise of one of its component parts. Anyway, who was another one? Nixon Hire. Now they're quite a big regional plant hire company, and they were in general plant as well. And they've decided to get out of small plant and earth moving and that kind of thing, and focus on far more specific things like site accommodation and what was the other thing? Sort of site lighting towers,
yeah, and generators, and toilets and things like that, stuff that supports the process rather than does the work.
And I suppose the issue behind all this is, you know, are people not hiring diggers and dumpers anymore? You know, why are people getting out of this market? And possibly it's because it's overpopulated, too many people, and the margins are smaller. And if you specialize and become big enough in a particular sector, then you can be more efficient.
But there's another one. I mean, you mentioned we've talked before about Ardent and Nixon. But
the
latest one that's just last few weeks has said we're getting out of plant hire of heavy machinery and earth moving stuff is Buckingham Plant Hire.
Yes, yes.
And I don't think I'd entirely put two and two together that Buckingham Plant Hire was the same company as Buckingham Group Contracting, which went under. When did it go under? Last year?
Last year, I believe. Yeah. Well, they weren't the same company. They had
Buckingham. The contracting business grew out of the plant hire business.
Yes.
It started the plant hire business, moved into contracting. And then the Wheeler family that owned both companies, they sold the contracting business to an employee ownership trust.
Yeah.
In whatever 2021,
I believe.
Yeah.
Not that long ago.
So and then it was not too long after the employees took it over, the contracting business went out. But the contracting business remained Buckingham Plant Hire's biggest customer.
Yes.
And so they tried to sort of soldier on for a bit, the plant hire business, without their biggest customer. And after a while, I thought, no, it's all too difficult. And they're pivoting. They're not folding the business. Buckingham Plant now still exists, but like rather like Nixon, they're pivoting away from Earth Moving Machine, a heavy plant, yeah. and sending all of that to off to auction, which happens next month, I believe.
It does, and indeed.
Focusing instead on basically green stuff, the light plant services offered by Ace Plant, which is
a company they bought. Yeah, 2016. That's
Bowsers,
right.
Actually, is what I associate Ace Plant with. They do more than Bowsers, but they're big and strong in Bowsers.
Yes. That's interesting. I suppose, you know, Buckingham Group Construction was a top 100 contractor and obviously doing a lot of work and needed a lot of plant, heavy plant for enabling works and stuff like that. And that was bread and butter to the Buckingham Plant Hire, which of course by that time was a separate entity entirely. But I think the contracting company accounted for something like 80% of their turnover. I might be wrong about that, but it was a huge chunk. And so when that disappeared, that was a massive blow, of course, and something had to be done. And again, the Wheeler family that launched Buckingham Group Contracting, Buckingham Plant Hire goes back about 50 or 60 years, I think.
Hang on, I want to pick you up on that. You say 80% of Buckingham Plant Hire's business was Buckingham Group Contracting. I don't think it could be as high as that.
Because it wasn't as high, okay.
I think it's more like 10%.
Sorry, okay, I've got my figures upside down in that case. But they were important.
But it's still a steady, reliable 10%, probably with a nice big margin.
Yeah, exactly. So, they've decided, Ace Plant, which they bought in 2016, that's doing very well. It's a thriving business. And they've decided, we'll basically Buckingham Plant Hire will become part of Ace Plant. And in fact, I'm not sure whether or not.
Well, that's almost the opposite. It's almost, I don't know what the name of the branding is going to be, but what Buckingham Plant Hire did, that's going, and they're only going to keep what Ace Plant did.
Yes, that's right.
So it's almost like Ace Plant taking over Buckingham rather than the other way around.
Almost. I don't know. I mean, just to let you into a small secret here, I am going to be speaking to them next week. So hopefully I'll be far more better informed than I am at the moment. I don't know exactly how they plan to go ahead, but I think it's an interesting story and one worth following. So we're going to find out what their intentions are. Clearly, they've reached an important milestone and they've had to choose a new direction. And it is obviously to go down the route that Ace Plant is already very well established in. So it's quite interesting that they've decided, we're going to get rid of these diggers. I don't know who's going to buy them. Be interesting to see who does want them after all. If people like Nixon and Ardent are getting out of diggers. I mean, I think something like 72 heavy excavators that Buckingham Plant Hire want to sell off next month. So there's quite a lot of very good and serviceable kit up for grabs there. So it'd be interesting who wants to buy it. But they're going to be focusing on the smaller plant, and I know that they are very keen to promote their environmental credentials. They're looking into sort of low carbon emissions and all that sort of thing. Everybody's doing it, of course. Everybody has to do it, and they're no exception. So that's their priority now. That's what's happening with Buckingham Plant Hire.
There's not, I mean, a rather different story, but another company pivoting away from plant hire is Hercules Site Services.
Yes.
The founder, chief executive of Hercules, Brisk Corkmount, was one of our, in fact, he might have been our first guest.
He was
one of our very early guests on the Reconstruction podcast, back when they floated on the alternative investment market of the London Stock Exchange in 2022. And they essentially, Hercules Site Services, as its name suggests, it's a labour supplier. It's a labour agency. But it always had a sideline of a few suction excavators. And with the money it made from the flotation, a lot of that went to, and they didn't, I think, another share raise, money raising a couple of years later or last year or something, money to buy more. And it built up a fleet from, I think it started with 9, and built it up to 30 over the past couple of years, such an excavator, these sort of, you know, trucks which have big vacuums.
For street works, you know.
So drain clearing. Yeah. Well, more trench excavation, and really quite heavy-duty things. And it was always kind of odd of why is a labour-only supply agency operating a fleet of suction excavators.
He was a big player in the market, wasn't he?
I think it was just an opportunity that he saw and thought, yeah, it's another string to my bow, another revenue stream, rather, instead of putting all your fish in one basket. Mm-hmm. Fish? That'd be a bad idea. Eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
do this as well. And it seems to me that they now decided that they're getting rid of that. I don't know whether they're going to sell it as a job lot or whether they're going to be sent back to the manufacturer if they've got them under, on higher purchase agreements. Or they've only said at this stage, we are divesting ourselves of this.
Yeah.
So exactly, you know, whether a new player takes over Hercules vacuum excavators, suction excavators, I don't know.
Yeah. But
it's interesting that they're giving that up. And I think it's partly because the growth they've had in their core business has been even stronger than the growth of the vacuum excavator market. And it doesn't fit. And they've got new investors. They've got new people in who have clearly looked at this. And you know, the original founder, Bruce Corkmaz, it seems like it was his train set. And he thought,
exactly.
And he's probably not quite as in sole charge as he used to be with all this other, you know, money coming in. And other people are kind of going, this is bonkers, mate. Get out of this. We've got a golden egg here in the labour supply business that we're doing.
Focus on that.
Stick to our knitting.
Because it was, the suction excavator division really wasn't contributing much to the business overall, was it? In fact, I think you reported it's 5% of group revenue,
But 88% of its debt.
Yes, well, yeah, do the maths, as they say. You know, it's. I'm sure that the investors who came in would say, well, that's got to go, and you can't really blame them. I think you're absolutely right. Comparing it to a train set, I think it was something that Bruce Corkmaz thought, these are great, these things, you know. You put this hose in the ground, it sucks all the earth out, and you know, nobody gets electrocuted, and you don't cause gas leaks and stuff like that. It's great, and I bet they're fun to watch and probably pretty good fun to operate as well. And he probably, as you say, probably saw a gap in the market. Not many people are doing it, and decided, well, I'll corner that little market for myself. But the sums don't really add up, do they?
So, but I wouldn't be surprised if a new entity, organization, is created or does emerge to take ownership of this fleet of 30 suction excavators. Mm-hmm. Bruce Corkmaz himself may put in a few bob to have a role in it, as a sideline. Yeah, corporately, completely separate to Hercules.
Yeah.
But, you know,
just to keep a dog in the fight.
Just to prove everyone that he was right.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, you could compare it to the sort of concrete pumping sector. It's a small, highly specialized sector of the industry that revolves around highly specialized equipment. In fact, it's almost the opposite of concrete pumping, isn't it?
Concrete vomiting. No, the opposite, yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's concrete suction.
Yeah.
So it's the sort of thing which I suppose if you do carve yourself a nice little niche in that sector, then maybe, you know, you can keep the competition at bay. Although I imagine the competition amongst the few companies that are specializing in it is very, very fierce. But yeah, I suppose that Hercules decided that it's time to focus on our core business, which, after all, is the really profitable bit, and let somebody else tackle the suction excavation.
Nice. Any other business, David?
I don't know. You mentioned one or two things which I'm sure we'll come back to in the future. So there was just a snippet on the news this morning that I almost heard in passing, which was that people. Do you remember that Boris Johnson was
who?
You remembered Boris Johnson? That
who? Yeah. My bad. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, but he was the MP for Henley, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And right underneath the Heathrow flight path. And
no, he was MP for Uxbridge.
Uxbridge, sorry.
Latterly, he was originally at Henley before he became London mayor. And when he was parachuted back in, it was Uxbridge.
Right,
even
okay.
more Heathrow MP.
Yes, absolutely. And you were dead against the idea of a third runway. Do you remember? Everybody is saying we need a third runway.
He said he would lie down in front of the bulldozers.
Well, it sounds like people are talking about a possible third runway at Heathrow again. And also an additional runway at Gatwick.
Well, Gatwick's story is not building one. It's bringing the one. They've got a spare runway.
They've got a spare one. They want to bring it into operation, don't they?
Yeah. It's more of a licensing thing. Well, I'm sure they'll
be. But again, how does our carbon sensitive Labour government square that particular circle? Because after all, one of the big objections, I mean, obviously, if you live under the flight path of Heathrow or Gatwick, you've got a vested interest in whether or not you have more airplanes flying over you. But if you don't, and your concern is about climate change and meeting our 2050 zero carbon commitment, then encouraging more air traffic at our two leading airports, Heathrow and Gatwick, doesn't really make sense. But here's the government saying, well, I think we might look at this again.
Well, it's going to be, I think my understanding is that the Chancellor is making some big infrastructure speech next week. And there's also a suggestion that there may be a thumbs up or some positive wind blown behind the Lower Thames Crossing, the tunnel that's proposed between Kent and Essex. Mm-hmm. And the newspaper reports that, or the TV bulletin you heard, or radio, whatever it was, this is all flagging up, rolling the pitch for this speech next week.
Yeah.
The point about Heathrow in particular, it will be 40 years before anything happens there, because there's so much, even though they've done an awful lot of work, it is not a, what do they call it, shovel-ready project. Yeah. The M25 needs rebuilding. Before anything. I mean, there's just too much. I think it's posturing. It's just the government trying to reinforce we're the builders, not the blockers. We'll say yes to anything.
Yes.
Bugger the bats and the newts. Let's just, go ahead, build everything. And that's the message that they want to send out.
Yes,
and
exactly.
We're looking again at Heathrow third runway is about
it's a risk-free. It's a risk-free strategy for
because
them, isn't it?
It won't happen while. Well, it might happen when they're in office, but it'll be their fourth time around from now, I think. And by then, I think the theory is we'll all be travelling in either hot air balloons or hydrogen or lithium-powered aeroplanes. Anyway, yeah. I mean, there will be no diesel in the world to fly aeroplanes. It'll be something else. That's the theory. Although air travel has changed remarkably little in the past, in my lifetime for sure. If anything, it's gone backwards. We used to be able to get from London to New York in, was it 2.5 hours or 3 hours?
I think it was a bit longer than that, but it was,
what did Concorde do it in? I mean, it's sparrow fart time.
I don't know. It was about 3.5 hours, 3.5 hours maybe.
Okay, you can't do that now. They give you a 2-hour slot to go London Belfast, even though you stand up in the air for 45 minutes or something.
Aircraft have become more fuel efficient, but they're also flying slower because you don't want to burn up too much fuel. And if people are going to sit on a plane for, I don't know, 3 hours, then make them sit on the plane for 3.5 hours, they won't notice. And then you don't burn up quite so much fuel trying to go faster. At least that's the way I understand it. I might be wrong.
Longer to sell them stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, I suspect when we reconvene in 2 weeks' time, David, we will be talking more exactly on that, on whatever it is that Rachel Reeves is going to say next week.
Yes.
We will be interested to talk about it.
Yeah. Yes, watch this space.
Okay, but for another episode of Reconstruction, I don't know what episode we're on. I've got Tom, the producer, has just come on camera in the background. Tom, what episode of Reconstruction have we just done here? It is our 169th episode. It'll be number 170, Psalm 170, next time, which will be in February.
Yeah.
But for another episode, everyone, thank you very much for listening. And if you've stuck with us this far, you're very tolerant. Thank you. And if you want to tell us anything at all, podcast at theconstructionindex.com. www.twitter.com/twitterpod.co.uk is the best way to get hold of us, because we don't do Twitter and Facebook, I'm afraid. Alrighty, from David and I, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.